Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week we take a look at the prison system and teaching particularly. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. And I'm joined this week by Joanne Schofield, who's done some teaching in prisons. Hi, Jo, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
First of all, tell us a little bit about what it's like getting into a prison, because I imagine you're in the situation where you're working in there and then you're with people. Obviously, they've got to stay there and you're coming out and they're looking at you slightly jealously, aren't they?
Well, no, actually, it's nothing like that.
No?
No. It's quite surprising until you actually go in. I remember sitting outside waiting to go in for the first time, feeling just completely nervous. But you go in, you get over that, and you do your teaching, and it's accepting. The people that are in there accept that you come in to teach, and you go, and they stay there. So it's pretty easy to come and go when you've got the right passes, of course, but it, also a great privilege.
No one was trying to swap their identity with you and get out then.
Funnily enough, they obviously knew me and didn't want to swap their identity with me.
Okay, so what were you teaching and where?
So I was teaching radio production skills, and I was doing that in Eastwood Park, and I was doing that with the adult females and with the juveniles. And it's a remand prison, so they were short-term prisoners, so they were just sort of there prior to sentencing or prior to getting moved on to a longer-term prison.
Now, remand is a bit weird, isn't it? Because the idea is that you haven't actually been convicted of anything, but you're a suspect, so they've got to keep you behind bars for one reason or another.
Yeah, it's actually, when you think about that, yeah. Yes, and I did a couple of times think that these people are in here waiting for sentencing, and they'll go to court and you'll be, well, will I see you again next week? I'm not quite sure. Good luck and see how that gets on. So it is unusual, and obviously depending on the severity of their crime, whether they come in and they're in remand prison. So yes, it makes it unusual and difficult as well for the teaching and education system within the prison.
But you're saying radio, so are you talking about prison radio, or were they broadcasting from the prison?
Well, not from our... The idea was we were set up at Eastwood Park to be able to broadcast from our prison, but we didn't do that. That's done from Brixton Prison. So we would send down audio and it would go through to them and they would broadcast it on their own prison radio. So if the system was set up as such that they could actually hear prison radio, it would be great. We would be able to produce stuff, send it off, and the females would be able to then listen to it. But for a while, they had no access to it and couldn't listen to it for one reason or another because their televisions weren't tuned in. So we were producing radio, and I was able to say, yeah, this is great. This is being listened to all around the country in prisons that have access to it, but just not yours yet. So it was interesting.
It's a bit bizarre, actually.
Yeah, it was. But we eventually got there and we had a very forward-thinking head of education there at the time, and she spent and invested a lot of money to be able to set that up. And in the time I went there to teach, I started off teaching. She had set this up, and by the time I'd left, she had gone because she had retired. The money had run out, and it never actually happened that Eastwood Park were able to have their own little broadcasting system there. We just produced it and sent it off.
So where is Eastwood Park? And you seem to be implying it's just women.
It is. It's just a female prison, and it's at it's on the A38 on the way to Dursley. Not very far.
Okay. How big is it?
It is, oh gosh, you've asked me now, I didn't get those statistics. There's a few thousand people there, but the juveniles, there could have been anything up to eight. They had a maximum of eight at the time I was teaching there, but often there could just be one. They had the facility to house eight juveniles, and that's 17-year-old females, but you know, often there might just be one because that's all they have, because they literally were only 17-year-old females.
Now, I have to ask you, what is the point of educating these young women in radio, especially if it's not actually even going to go out in the prison? And many of them will probably just go out into maybe, once they get released, they'll go into Civvy Street and into very ordinary jobs, so that the ones maybe perhaps that they've come from.
Okay, well, I would really advocate the fact that teaching radio is more about your personal skills, your life skills, and I can understand why you say what's the point of doing it, but I wouldn't have taught anything that I didn't believe in. And because we have community radio and it's all about volunteering, I was able to say to these girls, there is somewhere for you to go, because community radio is set up just for, well, not just for, but you know, specifically for people that are hard to reach, that need our help. And so there was somewhere where they could go. So what's the point of education? What's the point of teaching? I had great sympathy for the maths teachers, for the English teachers, for the people that were trying to teach these girls just your normal life skills that you would need, because they would often sit around thinking, well, an English O level is not going to get me a job, it's not going to help me when I get outside, and I could understand where they were coming from. But if I sat somebody behind a microphone and we went through the interview skills and we went through the eye contact, thinking about the questions that you had to ask to produce a good radio programme, the outcome, the change in their confidence was amazing. And we would put on a production, because they, with the juveniles, they had something they did every year where their families came in and they were able to demonstrate to their families what they were doing in education. So things like making an advert or jingle, a 30-second advert or jingle, there's so much more to that. There's thinking about what it is you're trying to advertise, the sound, and listening to your audience and who they are, and having the confidence to just speak on mic. And for you, it's really easy. You probably come into the studio and don't even think about doing it. You put your fader on and you talk, but you forget that when you've got somebody there that's not used to making eye contact with anybody, let alone the person that you're asking them to interview, it's just fabulous to see the outcome of that.
There's another thing about radio, which is that for many people, it's, well, for the vast majority, it's something they listen to. Suddenly getting into the situation where, rather than being a kind of spectator, you're actually turning it into a programme. In other words, you're on the other side. So what effect does that have on people who you were training?
Actually producing, it was amazing, because what we were able to do was I would talk to the students and say, okay, right, we're here, you're here in this environment, we're going to produce a programme, we are going to, at the end of this 12-week course, we're going to make an hour's programme. What is it that you want to know about your environment where you're living at the moment? Who do you want to interview? Who do you want to speak to? Who do you want to make answerable? So it would be anybody from the governor of that prison. We may be able to get visitors to come in as well. It may be fellow students. It may be talking about their experiences. So they would think about what it was that they wanted the answers to. They would formulate and develop proper intelligent questions and produce that whole thing and actually just do the whole thing. It was just great to be able to give them that opportunity.
So going from a sort of spectator into a player, in a way. That's the way I see it, almost like a sports field, you know, from sitting on the sidelines watching it to getting involved.
Yeah, very different, because what they all did was they listened to music radio. And it was very much my teaching in juvenile prison was a two-way education, because there were some things that those girls introduced me to that I really was not prepared for. But, you know,
go on, come on. What, like what? Come
I
on.
Couldn't possibly. Some of the music and some of the lyrics. But, you know, it was a two-way thing. So at that time, I had to be prepared to be educated by their lives and what they needed to understand them, to understand what they needed to get from it. So, yes, they would start off that 12th week thinking, what can we do in radio? We just listen to music. We want to be the next best personality DJ. To then understanding that there's much more to it. Yes, there's the technical side. They would drive the desk. They would do all of that. To the producing, they would produce each other. To get a a group of six girls and each give them each a role, being a producer, a presenter, and to make them or to enable them to take on those roles, to mentor each other, to be a teacher to another one, to be a presenter, was just great. And so by the time they finished, they then realised that, well, there's much more to what comes out on the radio than us speaking.
Okay, so it's a terribly prejudiced thing to say, but I can imagine catfights going on if people are prisoners. You know, maybe they've done something wrong to even be there in the first place.
You know, in all my years there, I didn't really experience that. The students would come in and they would be in varying frames of mind, and you have to be able to appreciate that. You know, you'll get three girls come into a session, you're teaching them for 3 hours, so this is an intense session. They get a 15 minute break. I wouldn't do that to an adult. I wouldn't dare try to hold an adult's attention for 3 hours with just one 15 minute break on that sort of small scale. But you had to do that because that's the way the system it tells you have to do it within prison. So if you had to be very sensitive to how one of the girls were, how they were feeling, and if you knew that one of them really wasn't feeling that they wanted to work that day, and they would come to you and the prison officer, because you always had a prison officer with you when you were dealing with juveniles, so you would be briefed that, you know, these two just had a fight this morning and they've been separated. So that would be in your flexible planning. So I would be, okay, I won't be putting those two present together then. So you just had to be aware of how they felt. But there were, you could feel if something was brewing, and you would just deal with it and change the schedule as you saw fit.
Common sense, really.
Yeah, really.
Does prison work, do you think?
That's a big question, Tony. Does prison work? Okay, in what way?
Well, I mean, do people come out from a sentence behind bars and are they able to go back into society in any way a better person and maybe less likely to offend?
Okay, well, I can talk from experience of my own family, of my own son having spent so much time in prison, and I can talk from seeing the prisoners coming back in from when I was working in there. But the question of does prison work? Well, prison works for taking an offender off the street and stopping that particular person committing crime in the community for that particular amount of time. So, yes, prison works for that purpose. If you're saying that prison should be more than that,
well, then because that's what you were part of, sort of a bit of rehabilitation rather than just punishment.
Yeah, well, it's not just prison on its own. It's the whole network of support outside of prison. When somebody comes to prison, it's the last resort. They've been through the courts, they've been through the magistrates, their families, I would have hoped, have tried to help them. In prison, they are given a lot of support. They have access to education, physical and academic education. They have access. They have access to opportunities of where to... They're signposted to a lot of opportunities for education, accommodation and mental health facilities outside of that. When they walk outside of the prison gates, then it's dependent on, I believe, based on my experience with my own son, it's based on the support network of, A, in the first instance, I believe their family, or people that love them. You know, if they don't have the support of their family, somebody that loves them, somewhere where they can go that they know that they are safe and they can get helped for a period of time.
But, I mean, isn't the problem with quite a lot of offenders that they don't have that network in the first place? And so they go into jail for a while, they'll come out, and then they're straight back into that world where they don't have that love and support.
Sadly, through the experience of working with the juvenile girls, apart from one, and I think at the count, I think 250, I taught 250 17-year-olds, and I can remember two of them, only two, had what we would call a standard, not even normal, but a standard family, a mum and dad that were together and that they had that support. So for some reason or other, all of the others either had come from care or abuse or in some way a dysfunctional family background. So to be in prison at that point was just a result of just how that, what that child was born into, and the support that they did or didn't receive from family, friends, and the education system. So it's they get the help and the opportunities in prison. But yes, when they go out, a lot of the girls, the adults, when they were in class, would talk about doing the education, doing their time, and then going straight back out and picking up on the crime again. That was their intention. That's what they would be talking about. And as a teacher and not a prison officer, the women would come in, the students would come in and talk more freely than they would with a prison officer, because I was a tutor that would just come in and teach for a couple of days a week or a couple of hours in the juvenile prison and then just go. So the students felt much more relaxed to talk to you as a mate often, and so they would talk to each other without fear of picking it up as such. So there were a lot of things that I would hear and experience that these girls were just going straight back out there to the exact same place that they came from, and that was a bit disheartening.
Yeah, well, it's really frightening. I think there's quite a lot of people who, for example, they don't actually have a home to go to when they leave prison.
Yeah,
which is almost a guarantee that something's going to go wrong.
Yeah, the accommodation. Honestly, when I would drive up to work in the morning, the prisoners would be released at a certain time, and it was usually the time that I was driving in, and you would see. In the instance of my son, he was up in the borders of Scotland, and when he was due to be released, we went up, and it was just so exciting. We went up to pick him up. We were there waiting for him, and it was just great. And we took him home, and I thought that was just natural. That's how it should be. Every day I would come out and I would see the women and the girls walking out of prison with a black bin liner. And sometimes if there was two girls released at the same time, they'd be walking down the street with their black bin liners, with their belongings in. They would be given, I don't know, I think it's £32 release money, which would get them fare to the nearest train station. And that would be it. And I would just drive up thinking, where's your network? Where are your family? Where are your loved ones? Where are the people that are there to take you from prison and just to support you? And so that's what you need. That's what people need when they come out. But unfortunately, by the time they go in, that's what they haven't got.
Well, maybe this is a result of the nanny state. You know, we've had since the Second World War a state which has for decades has housed people, made sure that homeless people have got somewhere to live. That's kind of over the last 15 years or maybe a bit more has kind of fallen away. I wonder if you think that may be partly why people are just not prepared for this kind of harsh society where the state doesn't really look after you so much anymore.
I don't know. I don't see that, Tony. I don't feel that when you say that we've been in a nanny state that have always housed homeless people.
Well, since World War II, up until probably the 1980s or so, there was, you know, it was actually much easier to get the state to house you through the system. Nowadays, it's much more difficult, for example.
It is, but that makes you feel so despondent because, yes, there is. You only have to go just sadly around the streets of our own city, Bristol, to see how many homeless people there. They're not all, you know.
Well, the official figures are about 15,000 homeless.
Yeah, that's horrendous. That's just really sad.
And something like, I think, 30 or 40 rough sleepers.
Yeah.
That's the official figures.
But do you know, speaking to these people, these are, what do we think? If we've never communicated with these people, who do we think homeless people are? What do we think? We stereotype them when we call them tramps. But actually, when you speak to them, I did an interview in previous years with one of them who, he was an intelligent man. He was in a relationship, had a family, a wife and children. The marriage broke down. He was a man. He left. He had nowhere to go. He sofa surfed for a while, ended up sleeping on park benches. And there he is, just on the streets. And you think, but where? How must you feel when that situation, that could happen to anybody? And also a majority of our veterans are on the streets.
I was chatting to someone from Portsmouth just a couple of days ago, and they were saying that over Christmas, a woman near Portsmouth opened up her garden with some tents and things and just housed homeless people, and every single one of them was an ex-serviceman.
That's shameful, isn't it? Absolutely shameful.
There were about 15 people turned up to stay in her garden in tents. Something wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And these people, really, we can say we owe our lives to. These are the people that go out, are prepared to give their lives for you and I. And they'll go and fight. They'll go and be involved in a conflict somewhere. They'll be affected in some way or other. They'll come back to their home country, and we do not give them the support that they need. And for them to be homeless, our heroes to be homeless, that's just criminal.
Well, too many of them get together, then they might do something about it, because they certainly had the training to move things, haven't they?
Yes.
Anyway, on another tack, Joanne, your experience in radio also includes things like Radio 4, so tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. Radio 4 was an experience. It was a fabulous project. So it was just as I was sort of deciding to come to the end of my own sort of production and radio career. And I got an opportunity to be in a pilot project within Radio 4. And it was about getting people together, two people together. It was called the Listening Project. So it was about finding two people and asking them to talk about a subject that they wouldn't ordinarily talk about. So, for example, it would be, one example was a girlfriend talking to her boyfriend about the way that her mother had deserted her. So it's, that was just part of their lives, but to ask those questions, to sit them down. And I did a 12-week run of this and spoke to 30 couples from one area of life to another. And it was incredibly emotional. I would sit them down and they would be in the studio. I would get about 30 to 40 minutes of audio, and you had to edit it to a maximum of 3 minutes. So you had a beginning and middle and end. And the brief from Radio 4, let me give you a secret here, was you have to make the audience cry. You have to get some emotion out of this.
It was a bit Disney effect
but
in
it
the
was,
background.
It didn't, no, it didn't feel Disney. But it genuinely, these people would get together and talk about the abuse that they suffered at the hands of their family, the desertion by other members of the family, some happy occasions. And it was really, really emotional. It was lovely. And it was just somebody talking, a grandmother talking to the granddaughter about her memories of her own grandparents in the war. And there was always tears, Tony. There was always tears. And it was just lovely. And you would walk away from that thinking, we don't talk enough. We don't talk enough to each other. And it was a fabulous project.
Well, that's a good message there to end on, I think. Joanne Scofield, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now, Louisa Latorre is interviewing Albert Calais, and I think she'll probably pronounce it better because she's Spanish. So I hand over now to Louisa.
Hello, this is Luisa, and I'm here today to speak with Albert. Albert is a Spaniard who lives here in Bristol. He has put together a website, blog, called Bristolenos, and it's a website that is written for those Spaniards who live already in Bristol and those who are already planning to move to Bristol. The topics include news, paperwork, to live here in the UK, live in the UK, tourism, living, learning English, and also just life in general about living in Bristol. So, Albert, I wanted to ask you, how old is your blog and what prompted you to create it?
Well, I arrived at Bristol 2.5 years ago, and when I was looking for some information about the city, I discovered that it's difficult to find all the topics that all the Spaniards or the immigrants in general try to find out, like how can we get the national insurance number, mm-hmm. where do we register to vote, this kind of paperwork or different kind of things that you have to do at the city council. Mm-hmm. That people is worried about how to fill your CV in the British style, or what kind of rule for living, not rules, but, you know, all the kind of manners that is the common in the city for the people that doesn't know how to.
Yeah, so it's just practical advice to live in the UK, from paperwork that you have to do to just general advice, work life, fun, tourism, trips, all kinds of good stuff that you can find on the website. I wanted to know, do visitors to the website, do they tell you what kind of topics they want to see covered, or do you decide on your own what you are going to write about?
Depends. Usually I've got a list that I've been getting from all my experience, you know, because when I get, when I've got a doubt during the day, how can I do this? How can I get that information? Or just I'm interested in something during my day. You say I write it down and say, okay, I'm gonna write about this topic in the future. So I've got this long list with all the information that I think is useful for me, first of all, and then I like to share it to the others. And then usually, you know, every week I get like dozens of emails from different people who is living actually in around UK that wants to move to Bristol, or they plan to from Spain, and they ask me about how can I do this, how can I find a new flat, or how can I get a job, something like that. No, it's the typical stuff.
What do you believe that the Spaniards think about Bristol in general?
You mean the Spaniards living actually
in Bristol? Do they like it?
Yeah, I did a survey time ago, last year, and I asked this question, how is your life in Bristol? How do you rank different kind of questions? For example, people said mostly all the questions they answered, like their life is good or very good, in all the topics like job, kind of leisure time, parties, nightlife, all the stuff. Also, it's like a third of the people has a good job, better job than they could get in Spain. The other is halfway. I mean, something related, but not in their fields. And the other third of the people is just working at this
low-wage job.
Low-wage, work jobs, yeah.
Anybody who walks around the center of Bristol can see that there certainly seem to be lots of Spanish speakers here. What do you think has drawn immigrants in general to this place? Is it work, job prospects, or is it just the fact that the UK, Bristol, is closer to Spain?
I think it's a mix of everything. Bristol has this kind of fame about it's an independent city. It's very open. Also, it's well communicated. So the Bristol Airport communicates with, I think, 15 different airports in Spain, direct, like usually Ryanair or EasyJet. You know, they've got a lot of routes. Also, the fame of Bristol came from all this kind of news that is the best city to live in UK. Also, the unemployment rate is quite low. It's lower than the UK average. Also, you know, for people that is looking for a job in engineering, there are a lot of opportunities for engineers or for the healthcare. So.
What do you think Bristol can offer to immigrants that London or other bigger cities can't, and why? I mean, what is it about Bristol that could be better for somebody starting out that is probably much better here than London or Manchester or any other bigger cities in the UK?
Well, I'm not sure. Depends on each case, but you say probably the cities, the lifestyle in general is more laid back.
Yeah.
In London or this kind of big cities, always there's this rush that and you have to live so far away from the cities and all the places that you say immigrants work. And in Bristol, you can just walk to your job or ride your bike, something like that. It's quite close. You know, it's this kind of mix. Also, the wages, they are not so far from London. I think Bristol, the average last year was the third of UK. So there's not much difference. So if you have to spend out of money in the rent in London, there's not worth to live there when you can live in Bristol. And then if you have a spare time, you can travel to London and enjoy the life there without all the
hassle and all the problems and the rush and the pressure. Yeah, it seems to be that you can probably stretch your pounds much better in Bristol than you could in a bigger city. Have you felt welcome here in Bristol?
Yeah. When I came, also, you know, as you can notice, my English is not as good as it should be, probably. But when I came, you know, was my English was worse than now. But you know, I felt very supported by my company. My company didn't care about this or my situation. They encouraged me to live in Bristol because I could choose different cities. And for example, my boss was like kind of a father for me, very supportive, encouraging all the time. Also, the people that I met in Bristol, they was very friendly. I never felt this kind of any bad reaction from my origins or something like that. So I think it's a very open mind city.
Open, welcoming city.
Yeah.
In your opinion, do you think that the Spaniards are people who are willing to emigrate, or would they rather stay in Spain in general, based on what the information that you
emigrate
can see?
To Bristol or
To get out of Spain in general. I mean, based on what you read on your blog and all, I mean, you know a lot more than lots of people about how Spaniards fare in the UK because of the blog that you're running.
Yeah. So by the knowledge that I get from the feedback that all the Spaniards give me to me every week with all the mails and messages, I think probably 5 years ago, the Spaniards that they came at that time, they had this kind of aim of adventure to live abroad or, you know, experience a new kind of life, learn about, you know, the British lifestyle. But now the situation in Spain is quite difficult for the graduates, the young ones. They feel that they have studied a lot of, you know, long time, and they don't have this kind of opportunities that they can find here. So, because the unemployment rate for under 26, I think, is 50% in Spain, it's quite high. So, there are a lot of engineers. Also, for example, this just an example. In UK, there are 64 million people. And Spain is 46 million people. And there are, in right now, in this year, they were at the universities. There are 700,000 students in UK, and in Spain is 0.4 million. It's double. It's twice. It's twice the number of students. So they're going to be out of engineers or teachers, out of graduates that they're not going to have, or they're not going to get any proper job in Spain in a short period of time. So they're thinking about, you know, living abroad is the only chance that they get now.
Yeah. How long... Let's talk about you a little bit now. How long have you been in Bristol?
2 years and a half.
Would you like to talk a little bit about how you ended up here? Why Bristol? Why not London? Or
I got this idea of living abroad. But my first idea was London, as you know, because it's the famous city. I didn't know much about any other places in England or in UK. But five years ago, I ended up in Plymouth, just doing some labor practice and studying English. So I discovered that there's a different kind of life outside of London, more British traditional style, you know, this kind of rush, and less expensive. So I decided I had to live abroad, you know, for a long time. And I came back to Spain. I spent a couple of years, and when I got the savings and I was a bit fed up of my previous job, I quit it, say my boss goodbye, and I moved to Bristol because I had a friend here, and he told me, you know, out of good things that you can do in Bristol. Also, it's well communicated to Barcelona, my born city, so I can visit my family a lot.
So before we are wrapping up the interview, I just wanted to know, what is next for bristolenos.com? I mean, what is next? Do you have any plans to expand the website, or or do you just want to leave it the way it is right now? Or
I'm trying to improve it every day. I started just with some topics about Bristol. Then I noticed that all the information that you can use for Bristol, you can use it much everywhere else in UK. So I started to write about different cities because during the weekends I like to go to different cities like Manchester, Liverpool, Cornwall. I like the Cornwall area. So I'm like a traveler, very tourist person. So I'm trying to get like write a manual for the new migrants, just to get all the information together, just to make the things easier. Because if you get the information in one point, you know, it's better for the British because they don't have to help the Spaniards help themselves.
Themselves, exactly. I just wanted to tell our listeners, our public, the website is called bristolenos.com. Would you like to share an email address before we go?
Yeah, my email address for any kind of
feedback
is bristolenos, bristolenos @gmail.com.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Hi, I'm Angela Balassi. Football is a sport which perhaps does not always have a good name. But here in Bristol, rival teams City and Rovers are showing what good sports they are as they prepare to play together in aid of six-year-old local boy Oscar Pycroft, who has severe cerebral palsy. The teams, along with celebrities and donors, will play on Sunday, February the 8th, to raise money for City supporter Oscar so that he can have surgery which may enable him to walk. I'm joined by organiser Ross Simmons and sponsor Della Hudson of Hudson's Accountants. Ross, can you tell me what inspired you to hold this match?
Well, basically, we went to a Bristol City game where Oscar attended, and he came out at half-time and basically just told the fans of his plight and what was happening and if people could donate after the game into the buckets. I was sat with Lee Rackham, who works for Zero to Hero. Zero to Hero is a boxing event where people that have never done boxing before would go and do a boxing event. So he said, why don't I do the event and raise money for Oscar Pycroft in that way? So I was kind of in a position where I couldn't say no. So that's where it started from. And then the fight isn't till May, so we thought of doing an event to raise more money and awareness in between that. We're both lifelong Bristol City fans. He's a big football fan, so we thought, why not do a charity football match? So that's where the idea came from, really.
Okay, great. And how will this money help Oscar?
Well, Oscar's hoping to raise £50,000 towards his operation. So if we can, you know, put a little dent in that, if you like, or raise as much as we can for that, then obviously that's what it's going to go towards. So it'd be money for his operation and aftercare, and there's also equipment that he'll need after as well. So, it's all going to good cause.
And Della, could you tell me why you got involved, please?
Much the same sort of thing. I have friends who are City supporters, friends who are Rover supporters, and both teams did bucket collections and raised money towards Oscar. But also, I've got children similar age, and the thought of my son being in that sort of plight, I'd want something to happen. So we decided that we would get involved and sponsor the shirts and whatever else Ross needs to get that going.
Thank you. Ross, sometimes football gets a bad name. Do you think this will help change people's perception of football?
It does have a bad name, but I think, you know, that's a small minority that may tarnish the game. I think the majority of supporters are people that just want to go and watch football and support their team. And, you know, I take my kids to football, so it should be a family thing. And I think people, you know, given the opportunity, respond to that. And I think, you know, whether you're a Bristol City fan, a Bristol Rovers fan, whether you don't even like football, something along these lines where you're trying to help out, you know, a local boy that needs an operation for something, I think football takes a second place to something like that. So any rivalries between people kind of just diminishes. And I think it's a good common ground for people to be involved. So, yeah, it's good.
And I understand there are some local celebrities taking part. Could you tell me who some of these people are?
Yeah, we've got ex-Bristol City and Bristol Rovers players that are playing in the game. That's Scott Murray, Lewis Carey, Steve Phillips, who played for both Bristol City and Bristol Rovers. A Somerset cricketer. We've got a couple of ex-pro boxers, Danny Butler. And then we've got Dean Beresford, who is the ITV weatherman. Alex Beresford, sorry. And then we've got Dean, who's a celebrity chef on ITV. He's come along as well. We've got Ollie and a couple of others from a boy band called Overload, who are on this year's X Factor. We're also talking to a few other people, but if they can be available, then they'll be there as well. So, yeah, it's been a good response. And obviously, the celebrities or people we've got involved are mainly local people, so they want to get involved because Oscar's a Bristol boy. So.
Okay, and I understand Della is sponsoring the kits, which you hope to put out for auction on the day. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me how people can get involved, please?
It's not. You can just turn up on the day. It's not tickets, it's not pre-tickets. It's £3 for adults and £1 for kids. It's at Bristol Manor Farm. It's just on the Portway, if people don't know it. After the game, we've got, like you said, we're going to raffle off the shirts or auction off the shirts. But we've also got a lot of other things that are going to be auctioned off as well, so I think we've got an England shirt signed by England players, Manchester City shirt signed, some other sports and memorabilia as well. There's bucket collections. We've got Banksy Castle for the kids. So there's loads of stuff that's going on. So, you know, anyone that turns up, obviously they're paying to come in. The people that are playing in the game have donated money as well. So not the celebrity team, but my team, if you like, because Oscar's going to manage the celebrity team and I'm going to be managing the donators. So that's more money that's been put in that way as well.
And how much do you hope to raise on the day?
It'd be really nice if we could raise around 2,000. I think, personally, I've raised nearly 2,000 myself, so if we could, you know, double that, and then the boxing event, obviously, in May as well, then we can get up to a good total.
OK, as a reminder, if people would like to get involved or sponsor the event, they can call Ross on 07 9 444 0449 or email ross_simmons@hotmail.com. And also you can make donations to justgiving.com/Oscar-70. Thank you, Della, and thank you, Ross.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Back in the late 1990s, the Prophecy Club in the United States took a series of unique insights into prophecy. Not Old Testament style, but modern prophecy with the focus on how the Bible could be speaking directly to us today. Gail Ripplinger is a US writer who uncovered some shocking ways in which Rupert Murdoch's version of the Bible, the translation which he owns is called the New International Version, misses out entire phrases from the original Greek Bible, deleting references to fasting and prayer. And even whole sets of verses are gone, as they are from the New King James Version, which Gail believes has been altered. So here's Gail Ripplinger talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions.
Now, there's an interesting sidelight to what's happened here in this research in statistical science, and that is the Hebrew text that they used here is the Hebrew text called the Ben Hakim or Rabbinic Bible that underlies the King James Version, all right? They tried the same mathematical analysis with the Samaritan Pentateuch, and it didn't work. It does not work with the manuscripts underlying the New International Version, the New American Standard Version, the Living Bible, Good News for Modern Man, Contemporary English Version. It doesn't work with that Hebrew text. That is a different Hebrew text. It's called the Stuttgart Edition, and it's a corrupt edition that was created around the turn of the century by a gentleman named Rudolf Kittel. Now, Rudolf Kittel, when you look his name up in the Jewish Encyclopedia, you will find that he is, number one, anti-Semitic, and number two, has contributions in his writings from the Hellenistic mystery religions. And so for those people who knew him at that time, he appeared to be an anti-Semitic person in his writings, and so the Jewish people have never accepted his Hebrew translation. However, when you go into a Christian bookstore today, what you will find is that Hebrew text underlying the NIV and the NASB and these modern translations, and that's very much in part why they are so different. But I can't imagine God using an anti-Semitic person. As a matter of fact, Rudolf Kittel's son Gerhard was tried and convicted of war crimes in the slaughter of the Jewish people. He was Hitler's high priest, and he created slanderous propaganda against the Jewish people. So his whole family had been anti-Semitic. And fortunately, the King James Bible does not use that Hebrew text. Okay, now part of the reason I wrote the book New Age Bible Versions, this is the book I wrote, and I spent 6 years collating the modern translations of the Bible. Years ago, I was not a staunch King James believer. As a matter of fact, when I would write letters to my mother, I would change the Bible anytime I wanted to. I really wasn't educated about the subject, and I was a young Christian. But I found that the young ladies who would come into my office at the university, I was a professor and they knew I was a Christian, and when they had emotional problems, they would come into my office and cry, and I would show them a verse in the Bible or something to help them feel better. And I noticed that those who were using the modern translations seemed to be unstable, emotionally depressed, anxious, all those sorts of things. And it made me stop to think perhaps that's why psychology has moved into the church, because of some of the problems these versions have caused. But as I was collating those translations, impeded by my love for these young people at the university who seemed to be having problems, and I really wasn't quite sure that it was coming from these versions, but I saw that there was a problem. I looked in Matthew chapter 4:18, for Jesus came to heal the brokenhearted, and that verse is completely omitted in the new versions. Looked at something simple like be of good comfort in Luke chapter 8, entirely omitted. The mercy of God, entirely omitted. As a matter of fact, the mercy seat, which is 53 times in the Old Testament, has been entirely omitted in the NIV. No more mercy seat in the NIV. So it's sort of some kind of a lid now. I don't know what kind of a lid it is, but Mark chapter 3, power to heal the sick, completely omitted. Acts chapter 3, the lame man was healed, completely omitted in the NIV. Okay, now, they've created a caricature of God, I found, in the new versions. For instance, when we've got Ephesians, Jesus nurturing his church. Nurturing comes from the word nurse, as a mother would nurse her children, holding them lovingly. Okay? Or humble, 1 Corinthians 12, God nurtures us and he humbles us. Okay? In the new versions, it says discipline and humiliate. Now, can you imagine wanting to go to a God who was going to discipline and humiliate you? I can't imagine either. And now I see why those young ladies that I suggested go home and read their Bible would come back and they would be more depressed than they were when they left. Now, we're going to be looking at some of the omissions in new versions, and what you will find as we go through these omissions is that the omissions in the new versions serve to make the Bible accommodate other religions. Now, if you were a marketer, you would know that that would increase your market share. If you can include other religions, then you can sell more Bibles. If you can include every denomination, not just born-again Christians, but the liberal, you know, seminaries and the liberal churches, if you can include everyone, obviously you can sell more Bibles. This is what's happened. Now, the main tenet of the New World religion is tolerance for the religious beliefs of others, all right? So you could say the New World religion is inclusive. It includes everyone. As a matter of fact, it will even include Christians if you want to join, all right? Now, Christianity is exclusive. Jesus said, "No man cometh unto the Father but by me," all right? What you will see in these new versions is that they allow a broader kind of a definition. Now, looking up at these samples I've shown you here, a simple verse to teach a child is 1 John 4:14. The Father sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Okay, all one-syllable words. But we have one Father, the Father, one Son, one Savior, in one world. Okay? Now, when we look in the new versions, NIV and NASB, you will see that they have a God, one of many, who sends a son or avatar with a message to each age. And so with the new versions, you will see a gospel, a message, a God, a son, a savior, and an age, rather than the God, the son, the savior, and the world. One way or many ways. Okay?